This is a story of the 60s scoop, of a family torn apart and separated for decades before being reunited. This is also a story of identity and the long-lasting effects these separations can have on a family. I'm Dave Breckenridge, and this is 10-3. London Free Press reporter Randy Richman joins me to discuss how one family was separated by the 60s scoop, ultimately reunited, and how they had to reckon with their own histories and come to terms with trauma and tragedy. Don't forget you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, Amazon Music. I'd love it if you could leave us a rating, a review, and tell your friends about the show. So Randy, your latest feature for the London Free Press really looks into a family tragedy almost, detailing the way that the 60s scoop impacted the lives of a whole family, really. And I do want to obviously talk about the details about all of this, but for people who may not understand, and I know for a lot of Canadians, there's a somewhat of a lack of understanding about what the 60s scoop was. Can you just give us, a bit of an explainer as to what it was and broadly what it did to kids and their families?
Sure. The 60s scoop kind of followed the residential school system. After that was sort of phased out, provinces took over welfare of Indigenous children, and from about 1960s to early 1990s, that led to the removal of about 22,000 children from their homes, sent to foster care or adopted by mainly white families all across the country. And so these kids were basically taken from their homes, sometimes for reasons that child welfare thought were good reasons, but the ultimate impact was kids again were taken from their homes, ripped away from their family, from their culture, from their language. It was kind of like the residential school system in a different way. And you're right, it's not as well known by Canadians. There's been lots of focus in the National Commission on the residential schools, but the 60s scoop is kind of this, not hidden, but it's just not as well known problem that impacted thousands and thousands of lives.
Now, when you say it's these kids taken from their homes, in some cases were they seized by child welfare authorities? In some cases were they given up by families?
Yeah, both for sure. Some cases the child welfare would come in and take them. Sometimes, child welfare would come in and the families were unable to look after them properly, according to child welfare. And again, we're talking about a generation of parents that were the kids of the residential school survivors. So, they were already damaged and struggling, and now they're raising their own kids. And so, there's problems in the household. And there was also, of course, the view from provincial authorities across the country that, they knew better, and it'd be better to put these kids with happy, so-called happy middle-class white homes rather than the homes they were in.
And I mean, this story that you did details, as I say, one family's experience as they grew up away from their own family. They grew up in adoptive families, and it takes us to present day. We're talking about 60 years almost. And it all started with a death in an Ontario prison. What can you tell me about that case?
Well, we've had a lot of deaths at the provincial jail here, Elgin Middlesex Detention Center. And so no one ever reports these deaths. We just hear about them. We get tips or family members tell us. So, unfortunately, this is probably the 18th or so death I'd heard about there in the past 10 years or so. So we always do the same things. It's almost sadly routine. We try to find out who died, and we try to find what we can from family members. So I found out that a man named Clayton Bissonnette had died in March 2021. His name wasn't out there very much, and nobody seemed to know much about him, but I did manage to reach his sister. And, on the surface, it was another jail story. He died of an overdose in the jail. The jail is riddled with illicit drugs. And then, I began to investigate that and how that happened. But when I started talking to his sister, I realized that there was a much larger story here. Every death has a story behind it. but not many have this kind of 60s scoop and split family story behind it. And the more I talked to her, the more I realized it deserved a deeper look. And she and I both agreed that rather than write a standard and sad story about a man who died in jail, that we should take some time and explore it further and, you know, get to trust each other a bit and let her and her family tell me their stories.
And I mean, the result is it's a harrowing story about kids who don't know who they are, about a family that's kind of torn apart by institutional practices of the day and trying to come together and come to some semblance of a familial relationship. And that's one of the things that I found, I think the most heartbreaking is how this family kind of came to know each other again and wrestling with even that piece of it. Is these are people who in another life, in another time, would have grown up with each other and known each other. And your story kind of partway through picks up with them all coming to realize that they have siblings out there. And we're talking about Clayton Bissonette, who also goes by the name of Danny. We're talking about Adrian and David and Paul. And how did they come to know that they had siblings out there? And how did they come to reconnect with one another?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, for some of them, like Adrian, it was a lifelong quest. She wanted to know more about who she was because she never really fit in with her white family. For other people like David, it became later in life where he promised his adoptive mom, because he loved his adoptive family, he promised he wouldn't look for his biological family, and he kept that promise until his mother died. So they kind of came at it in different ways, but all at the same time, just around early 2000s, they all started searching through Ontario's adoption agencies, just trying to find out who their parents were. The adoption agency, the parents had died by then, but connected them with each other. And that led to some phone calls and some emails. And finally, the three kids of one side of the family got together. And then they realized that, wow, we have all these other side, half siblings, I guess you'd call them. And so they reached out to them as well. And then there was a giant reunion of everybody all at once. And as you say, though, that's years, decades later. And instead of growing up as a family, you know, with our siblings that we all have connections with and routines and that we all fall into, they had to start all over again. And it didn't quite mesh as well as you might want because they'd all had their own lives since then. And there were kind of two sides to the family from two different fathers. Danny Clayton, he was kind of the bridge between the two of them. He was biologically, linked to the younger kids, but had grown up with the older kids. So he was kind of the key to connecting. And he was pretty standoffish at first. And later on in life, he decided that, that he wanted to become that bridge. And then almost as soon as he decided that, or almost as soon as he started coming back, his problems with prescription medications reared up and he went to jail where he died. And it's a missed opportunity for a family to finally reconnect.
What do the siblings remember about that period? Or what did they tell you about kind of coming to that realization that there are other family members out there and how they wanted to approach this? And did they expect that it was going to be a happy reunion, or did they have trepidation about it and concern about what coming together would mean for each of them?
Right. They had, I think it was a mixture of trepidation and some joy. I mean, as Adrian says, you finally find out you have brothers, but what if they're not nice people, or what if they don't like you, or what if you don't like them? David talks about how he says, like having a great Christmas present or something, or a big gift given to you, and you realize, man, there's some meaning here. What do I take from this? And Paul, he was happy with his life, and he was really reluctant at first to kind of join in because, they'd all created their lives. They're all adults. So it's a real mixture of emotions. Their first meeting with the three younger ones was great. The one with the older ones was a bit wilder. They tell me it was a bit more dramatic. And they each of them developed their own relationships with each other, as all siblings do, right? So with the older ones and with each other, they developed their relationships and they had good moments and bad moments. And sometimes there's falling outs and sometimes they get back together. But, for all of them, it was worth it. I think every one of them you would talk to would say it was obviously worth to them finding family, especially the three younger ones that the story focuses on. They felt a lack of identity their whole lives.
We'll be right back. Now, as you mentioned earlier, you know, the 60s scoop kind of a redo in a different way of the residential schools system where kids are taken away from their families. And in a lot of cases, the parents of these kids are kids of people who had been in residential schools. So there is already a generational trauma going on there. And so you may have parents who are, again, unable to take care of their kids, at least in the eyes of the state, because they're already wrestling with trauma. What do we know about the sibling's mother, how her kids came to be taken from her, and what was going on in their lives at the time?
Yeah, their mother, Mary Ellen, she grew up, and we're not sure if she went to residential schools because the records aren't all out yet. But she obviously had a troubled past. She was married very young and gave birth for her first child very young to a man many years her senior. He ends up going to jail at some point. She meets a new man and has more children with him. And, you know, her family, the stories about her are both sort of sad and mythical. She could be wild, and she drank too much and she got into fights, but she also defended her family. She was this tiny, beautiful woman by all accounts who had quite a fighting spirit in her. But, you know, alcohol got the better of her. And, you know, by the time the younger children came around, she was, you know, in a lot of trouble and stress. And, you know, she eventually died in the 1970s on the streets in Windsor, Ontario. She had been convicted of robbery and, you know, she had other convictions. And so her own life was sad and tragic. And, you know, she wasn't really perhaps capable of raising children by the time she was done. And so, you know, it was, again, one of those stories, as you were saying, that she herself went through a lot of trauma, you know, very early marriage for whatever reason, very early pregnancies, alcoholism, lots of trauma she faced. So how able was she to raise children? That's kind of the question, right?
Mm-hmm. And as we look at each of her kids, or the kids that you focused on in your story, they each kind of wrestled with issues in their own way, right? You know, we look at, you talk about Adrian and being in abusive relationships. We talk about David, who appeared to have, you know, a fairly stable childhood life, but as he got older and there were questions about his identity and their feeling like he didn't fit in, he kind of broke away. How did what happened to these people as kids affect them as they kind of approached adulthood?
Yeah, you raise a very excellent point. Actually, David and Adrian had vastly different upbringings. Adrian was in a home where, you know, she was abused and didn't like it and tried to run away and tried to kill herself and did run away and ended up in Toronto with, you know, men, a man who was not good for her, and spent her whole life until recently in bad relationships where she said, I was used to abuse, so I sought it. You know, David grows up in what he describes as a really wonderful and loving white family whom he loved and still loves. And, you know, I've looked up their names, and they are very accomplished people and, you know, have made significant contributions to the world. So he grows up in that family, and yet he also ends up on the streets of Toronto. In fact, he ends up on the streets more than Adrian, you know, addicted and doing all the things you need to do to survive. And it's kind of a interesting point that shows that no matter how great the environment is that you grew up in, if you feel that lack of identity, if you feel disconnected, it's going to harm you. David had all the chances in the world not to go down the road that he did, but he still did. And he still felt like he didn't have his own identity. And once he found out who he was, and Adrian felt like that all the way through it, and they ended up in the kind of the same spot.
And what about Danny or Clayton? I mean, this was the kicking off point for the story, and with the tragic end to his life in prison. He, if I recall correctly, he stayed with his mom and his dad, correct?
Yeah, he stayed with his mom and dad for a while, and then his mom, so the family story goes, at some point said they were separating, said, come live with me, and he decided to stay with his dad, and that's interesting. It's his choice at that point. I'm not sure how old he was. He was, and it's vague because he didn't like to talk about it much, but he was also sent off to some schools, perhaps in foster care at times, because being raised by his father alone wasn't great. It was, you know, there was some rough times there as well. We don't know the full story about that. And so he, you know, he stayed with his dad, very loyal to him. Apparently was very happy to be called Danny Boy Armstrong after being born as Clayton Bissonnette. But meanwhile, he loved his mother. He's the one who went to Windsor and bought her a headstone for her grave. He's the one who, you know, told his wife at the time, Tracy, about it and brought her there. So he had this, you know, interesting relationship with both of them. But he was also the most cautious about reconnecting with family. He was, you know, quite damaged by all this and very didn't trust people, even didn't tell his wife very much about his story sometimes. It would come out in bits and pieces. So, you know, he had a relationship with both, obviously troubled with both, obviously hurt him over the years and hurt his ability to connect with his siblings.
And then how did his addiction issues come into the picture?
Well, that's just it. Everybody always thought Danny Clayton was doing fine. He was a hard worker. He always had jobs, but it was a classic case of the kind of the first wave of opioid epidemics in Canada. He was a factory worker and he fell off a ladder taking down Christmas lights and he hurt his ankle and he goes to the hospital or the doctor and he gets Percocets, a painkiller. And then this happened a lot in the early 2000s. The pain kept coming and he started taking OxyContins, which are highly addictive. And soon enough, he's addicted to painkillers. Now, even before that, though, he had some problems with alcohol in the 1990s, but his marriage kind of solved that. He'd quit drinking. So, you know, things look great, but then he gets prescribed painkillers. He gets addicted to painkillers. His marriage falls apart. Years later, he's driving, you know, he's on all kinds of prescription medications for anxiety and depression and pain. And he gets in a car and he drives that car and he gets in an accident right in front of a police cruiser and gets arrested for impaired driving by drugs and goes to court. And the judge says, you know, this is basically a series of incidents, which makes you have to go to jail for 120 days, which, you know, maybe not fair, maybe was the right call. But in any case, he ends up in a jail and it's a jail that's notorious for having drugs in it. So, you know, here you are sentencing someone who's addicted to drugs to a jail that's got drugs everywhere. And this happens, unfortunately, in countless institutions, probably across the country. So again, he's in there and he's in isolation. He's supposed to be well protected. He's in quarantine because it's COVID. And, you know, somehow he gets drugs. He's, you know, there's four different kinds of drugs in his system when he dies. And that's always the big question. How in the world, inside a lockdown jail during a COVID quarantine, does someone get that?
Aside from the death and the issues with the prison, I mean, just looking at this story as a whole, did any of Danny's surviving siblings talk about the broader implications of how their lives unfolded due to the 60s scoop? It's a very personal story. There were issues that obviously came up for them through their lives and their brother's death. But Did any of them have any thoughts about the totality of it all?
Definitely. Adrian especially. Adrian is probably the most committed to finding out more about what it's like to be Indigenous in Canada. She has gone to dances and she's gone to all kinds of cultural experiences to find out more. She's found out her Indigenous name, and she has a great sense of what it's meant. And she actually helps the 60 Scoop organizations with counseling and peer support. So she has a very good sense of what it meant to be a 60 Scoop child, what it still means. And she's, you know, does a great job explaining very personally how it feels. David's interesting because has a kind of a split identity. He can, you know, he kind of says when he's around white people, he's a white person. When he's around Indigenous people, he's an Indigenous person. And I find that very revealing about Canada and how we're still not kind of reconciled, to use those official words. And Paul just kind of is like hesitant to go too far down that road because he's, you know, comfortable with his identity. And so Adrian's the one that talks about it most, but you can see the impact in all three when you talk to them about how they identify themselves.
For you as a journalist, what was your big takeaway from this? Or what do you hope readers of this piece will take away from it?
Well, every time I write a jail story, I hope that more attention gets paid attention to the jail. But to be honest, that doesn't happen. I mean, it has over, it's taken us 15 years at the London Free Press and other media across the country to make changes. It's a long-term project. For this one in particular, though, I just was fascinated by the family story and just how it gave us insight into this 60 Scoop. So for that aspect, I hope that people start paying attention to it and start realizing what the impact was and just learning about it. I mean, I have to admit, I mean, it paled in comprehension compared to residential schools, right? And you know, it takes Canadians time to learn, unfortunately, but I hope that it raises awareness of that. I hope people connect with the family and start paying attention to 60 Scoop. The 60 Scoop foundations and organizations, they would like a commission as well to look at it. They'd like an apology from the federal government. They have not received that yet. They want some sort of recognition and they want understanding of what they went through. They don't have it yet. And I hope this story is one of the, you know, small pieces that helps them get that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's certainly an important Canadian story, and I appreciate your time, Randy.
Thank you.
10-3 is produced by Tyler Dawson, theme music by Bryce Hall. Thanks to my guest, Randy Richman. More from him at lfpress.com. I'm Dave Breckenridge. Thanks for listening.